Angie's List is now Angie, your home for everything home. Angie still has the same top pros and reviews you've counted on for more than 20 years, only now you'll also get access to all the tools you need to make your home a happy place. Inside, outside, big or small, Angie helps you find the right solution for whatever you need done, all from your phone. It's simple to find upfront pricing and instantly book hundreds of projects. You can even search pricing guides to see what others paid for similar jobs and easily compare quotes from top local pros to make sure you're getting a fair price. From lawn care to repairing the AC to the project of your dreams, Angie has your home projects handled from start to finish. Plus, when you book and pay through Angie, they'll cover your project up to the full purchase price plus limited damage protection with their happiness guarantee. Make your home an Angie home. Check out Angie.com today. And for more on the happiness guarantee, go to Angie.com/happiness-guarantee.htm.
Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedy writer and comedian Sue Kalinske talks about the dog that saved her life.
I see a delivery truck and a little shepherd mix dog that could have only been a couple of months old tied to his truck. And I wasn't planning on getting a dog. I'm like, you know, I'm only going to be here for a certain period of time. And the corporate housing where I was staying didn't allow dogs. I fell in love with this animal. It was like this dusty colored shepherd mix that actually looked like a baby coyote. And we're wondering if, you know, who's this dog? Is this dog, you know, up for adoption or whatever? So I just said, I'll take the dog. And, you know, it was like that feeling of, you know, being at an auction and being the last bidder and then realizing I have no money to pay for this.
Today on the show, comedy writer and comedian Sue Kalinske talks about the little tiny dog that saved her life.
Hey, my name is Sue Kalinske, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. When you're a longtime fan of the show of over 10 years, or you're a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. I hope you guys had a chance to listen to the show last week with comedian Adam Ferreira. I don't know if you heard that or not, Sue. Did you hear Adam?
I didn't, but I love him.
Oh, do you? Good. Yeah. He's been in the comedy game forever as well.
Yes.
And so Adam Ferreira is so funny. His story is about being nominated for Comedian of the Year from the American Comedy Awards. Remember when they gave those out?
Yeah, sure.
In the late 90s, yeah.
Yeah. Ladman won one.
Yeah, Kathy Ladman, that's right. And that's a big deal, obviously.
Yeah.
So Adam Ferreira is up for Comedian of the Year, and he flies his parents out to, you know, to come do the red carpet and, and go to the show. And it is so funny. His parents are hilarious. They're just completely fish out of water. And it's just super funny, you guys. So go back and listen to Adam Ferreira talking about being nominated for the Comedy Awards and find out whether he won or not. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. So anyway, you guys, it's funny, man. You're going to love it. But not today. Not today, because today I'm here with comedy writer and comedian Sue Kalinske, and she brings forth the topic, The Dog That Saved My Life. And I just think that's the sweetest topic ever. I mean, you know, it just screams sweet. And I don't know. I love pets so much. I can't imagine somebody who doesn't love pets. But, like, I rescued a kitten this summer. There was a little baby kitten outside my apartment, and the third night I saw her, I was able to capture her or, you know, get her. It took me, like, an hour to lure her in, and I finally was able to pick her up and bring her in the house and give her a bath. And I showed a bunch of pictures on social media and stuff, and she was only 2 pounds, and she was, you know, dehydrated, and she had fleas, and oh, my gosh. I gave her a bath, and the water was black. Anyway, I got her to the vet, got her the shots, et cetera. And now she's super, super funny and cute. And you'll see her running around here, Sue. She's just adorable. I wouldn't say she saved my life. Uh-huh. In fact, she's kind of been a pain in the ass, but that's what kittens are, you know? Kittens right. are just, you know, they're just, they literally try to climb the walls. That's what kittens do.
Right. Anyways. Well, this isn't a pissing contest. This is not a pissing contest, right? Whether no. your pet saved your life, right?
No, this is not a pissing contest, thank goodness. But listen, I have to tell you, I'm really happy to meet you, Sue, because I've met so many people like in your circle, as it were, mm-hmm. including my brother from another mother, Ed Krasnick, because we share the same birthday.
Ah, cool. I love Eddie.
Anyway, yeah, we do have a lot of mutual friends. And I know that you got started in comedy back, I think I heard you on another show. I think I heard you on Judy Gold's show. And you said you started stand-up in 1978?
The first time I went on stage was 79.
Wow.
And yeah, I was, oh God, I think I was like 18 or 19 years old.
Sure.
And I did stand up a couple of times. I did it at the Improv in New York, and then I just kind of like let it go. You know, I actually passed, but I didn't stay with it. And then
You got passed at the Improv?
I got passed at the Improv in New York.
That's a big deal.
It was a very, very big deal.
How long were you on stage there doing open mics and stuff until you got passed?
I did. Actually, my first open mic at the Improv, I passed.
What?
and it was a 5-minute set.
Wow.
And I just, you know, I just didn't continue with it because I don't think I was like completely ready to like do this. But, you know, my whole style of stand-up had changed drastically because I started out in comedy as an impressionist. So my shtick was, because I have a deep voice, my shtick was that I did the wives of the men, but they sounded just like their husbands. I think
you
back on it now.
Give me an example.
It was so hacky. You know, it's like, you know, I did George Burns and I did Humphrey Bogart and John Wayne. Yeah, it was... I look back on it now and it just seems so silly to me. But I really want, you know, after watching so many stand-ups that I admired, I wanted so badly to have a voice.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a voice. I didn't have a point of view. I was just like doing this kind of novelty act. So, you know, it got me started. It got me in the game.
Well, I think it's exciting because you were that young and yet that creative. That's really thinking outside the box. I mean, most people wouldn't have just taken that chance. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, you know, I had been doing impressions ever since I was a little kid. You know, I grew up with, and I don't know if you remember this album. It was called The First Family, and it was Vaughn Meter. Do you remember who Vaughn Meter was?
I don't.
Vaughn Meter was the spitting image of John F. Kennedy.
Oh, wow.
And he, with a group of improv actors, did a album based on the presidency. And Buck Henry was one of the writers. I don't know a lot of the other writers, but I remember Buck Henry was. And they did these sketches, like Jackie giving a tour of the White House. Yeah. And Vaughn Meter's whole career was hinged on Kennedy's presidency. Wow. And then when Kennedy died, his whole career went down the tubes.
Wow.
And I, you know, it was a very, very sad time for him, but I grew up with that record. So I did John Kennedy when I was like 6 years old.
That is so funny. I just wrote that name down so I can remember to look it up on YouTube, but he had nothing else. He had nothing else in his pocket. That's just one impression. That was it. That was his whole
deal. That was it. That was his whole career. And apparently when someone called him to tell him that Kennedy was assassinated, he thought that it was a joke. He thought that they were joking with him, knowing that his whole career was that.
Jeez.
And yeah, and then I, you know, he became an alcoholic. I mean, it was a very, very sad, you know, demise of his life.
That reminds me a little bit of when Sarah Palin was running for vice president, and then everybody like automatically went to Tina Fey, like, oh my God, you're totally her, you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then she, in fact, played her on SNL. It's so funny.
Yeah, yeah.
You've written so much in Hollywood and out here in Los Angeles. Did you ever want to do more of a New York thing, or did you always want to do more the LA life? I mean, I know you worked on Sex and the City. Was that in New York?
No, it was here. Uh-huh. They shot everything in New York, but all the writing was done here.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I do not think a lot of people know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I only worked on it the first season. I had a writing partner, and who was a dear friend of mine who actually was a waitress at Stand Up New York. That's how we became good friends.
Funny.
And she moved out to L.A. And it was funny because we weren't really, really great, great friends in New York. But whenever I worked at the club, we always hung out. But we never socialized outside the club. I moved to L.A. and I found out that she was here, and we reconnected, and we became like the best of friends. And then we teamed up, and we wrote on two shows together. But we split up after the first season of Sex and the City.
So it was a writing partner. So you two were both writing together on Sex and the City. Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, you know, we really had no idea what the magnitude of the show was going to be. We knew it was really good, but we had no idea that it was going to explode into what it did. So
did you guys leave voluntarily, or did you get
she fired wanted no. She wanted to write on her own. She just felt that that was what her path. Mm-hmm. And so we split up, and I ended up I ended up going to New York soon after to do a radio show.
Yeah. So. Now, was that the sports blogger thing, or was that's much? What radio show was it?
Well, it's a radio show that leads into my story, basically. But it's I did a morning show on WNEW in New York, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and that was not sports. It was just a talk show.
Uh huh. Because you really have done so many different things, and I also know you're a huge sports fan. And I know you're a huge sports fan. And that's interesting, but also you worked on Top Chef. So
yes.
Did you have to get into cooking, or you were just writing?
Oh, no. I don't cook. I actually, the joke in my house, my husband used to be a chef.
Mm.
So he does, I would say 99% of the cooking. And one day we were planning a trip, and I said to him, you know, I'd really like to go someplace I've never been before. And he looked at me and said, why don't you try the kitchen?
Funny guy.
He is a funny guy. Right.
And what was that show called, Life After Top Chef or something like that? What was that?
Oh, God. It was probably the biggest nightmare of my career.
Wait, tell me, because what does it even mean, Life After Top Chef?
Well, it was four chefs who had been on Top Chef. So it was basically what their life was after the show had ended for them. And it was a very ambitious show because it took place in four different cities of where they lived. And, you know, what everybody loved about Top Chef was that they all were together. They lived in a house together, and it was their everyday interaction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And here you have four chefs, and you know, they were together maybe twice throughout the season. It was, I think, a 8-episode season or a 6-episode season, but there was really not a lot of story going on with them, you
because
know?
They didn't know each other really.
Oh no, they did. I mean, they did. You know, some yeah, they actually did, because they did most of these guys did Top Chef All Stars, so they definitely were on a season together. But you know, when you're in the Top Chef alumni, you know, you all pretty much know each other to a certain extent.
I see.
But you know, it really wasn't a compelling show. There wasn't a lot of story.
So what was it like? Yeah, like, okay, now we're heading down to Atlanta, Georgia, and we talked to so-and-so in his restaurant, and now we're in Arizona, and we talked to this guy about his restaurant. Is that it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there was more to it than that, but it was just boring because, like I said, there wasn't, it's not just about, it wasn't just about the cooking, you know, and it was a kind of a hybrid docu-follow of what their lives were, and their lives just, there wasn't a lot going on, you know? You try to accentuate the idea that they're opening up a restaurant, but like one of the guys already had three restaurants. So it wasn't like, oh, what's going to happen? You know, they always try to, you know, fill it in with all of this false drama. And at that point, you know, a lot of the chefs were so hip to it. I would interview them and they would be like, all right, I know what you're looking for.
Yeah.
You know, you want me to be like nervous and, you know, excited.
Yeah, where's my camera angle? Yeah, they know. Yeah.
But it was such a letdown from Top Chef, and it failed miserably. And it was a very, very, you know, and I was running post, so it was a very, very difficult show to do.
And can you tell us what that means, running post? A lot of people won't know that.
I was in charge of the story department and the editing staff. So, you know, we would put together what the arc of the season was going to be, what was going to be in every episode, and then all of the editing. I was in charge of all the editing with the editors.
Wow. So as that person, do you have to keep like very positive and enthusiastic, or can you say to the writers, look, I know this is shit and this is really hard, but we got to pull it together and get something on the page? Or,
yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a combination, because you couldn't mask the fact that the show was in trouble. Oh. And, you know, a lot of these editors I had worked with on prior, you know, I had worked with on Top Chef.
So they know you, yeah.
So they know me, and they knew what the deal was. And even my bosses knew. I mean, I actually sat in one of my bosses in her office one day, and the two of us just cried. You know, it was like, what are we doing here? It's horrible.
Do you remember what you were crying about?
Just crying about how, you know, it's like, how are we going to, like, work our way out of this? Because there's, you know, so much, you know, everything was shot, and, you know, you do have the luxury of going back at certain points and doing pickup scenes and try to fix things with interview. But, you know, some shows, if it's not there, it's not there. Mm-hmm. And you could only manufacture so much. Mm-hmm. And, it was just a no-win situation. And honestly, I think the show never should have happened, because I don't feel that it was vetted properly by all the big wigs involved, you know, from the network to the production company. Yeah. I just think it was really a no-win situation.
Well, they probably got excited about the idea that it was a spinoff of Top Chef, and they just went with it, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was really what inspired it.
So it's like The Bachelor, and then they spin off to, like, now there's a Bachelor in Paradise, and I think there's a Bachelor on an island. I'm not sure.
There's a Bachelor in my bathroom. Yes, yeah.
And then you wrote on the Osbournes, and at the time—
Well, I didn't write. I just want to correct you. There was no writing on the Osbournes. It was all just— they shot, and we grabbed the footage, and we made a show.
Okay, so what was your credit on the Osbournes?
I was a producer.
And so that was a really compelling show, actually, at least for a while there, because it was kind of new. As I remember, it was kind of new for reality TV. And the kids were involved. Everybody was curious about Ozzy. It was a pretty cool time. Is that right, or am I forgetting?
No, you're not forgetting. And I've been chasing that high my entire career. It was magical.
Wow.
I had never done anything like it. And you're right. I mean, it really was. It was what we like to call, it was like a reality sitcom, basically. And, you know, the beauty of that show was that you were basically a slave to the footage that you had. And in those days, there were no production companies. It was MTV and us and a bunch of, you know, independent producers.
Wow.
And you had to use what you had. So you had to be so creative. You never went back and did pick up interviews. You never said to Ozzy, say this. You never told anybody what to do or what to say. It was the purest of documentary on television, aside from a real documentary that's ever been done, and it's been bastardized so much over the years.
Wow, those are big words, Sue, really. Okay, so were you ever on set?
Yes. My first season, I was a segment producer, which meant that I split duties with two other segment producers. There was a morning, afternoon, and night shift. And sometimes we overlapped. And you would, they have this area, they call it Video Village, which is where the director sits and all of the monitors are, so you could see what the action is going on in the house. And there was a room set up in their house, which was amazing. And so I was there the first season.
Who's in that room? If Video Village is outside, who's in the room in the house?
Well, producers were inside where there were monitors. And then they had moved it. I guess years later, they had moved it into the garage or something. Mm-hmm. But so we were like right there. I mean, you know, I hung out with Ozzy. I hung out with Sharon. I knew the kids. It was.
What was the best shift? The morning, afternoon, or night?
Every shift was a great shift because you never knew what was going to happen with the guys. You know,
what time did it start in the morning? What was the first shift?
I think the first shift was probably started around 8 or 9, and the last shift, you know, could go until 3 o'clock in the morning because sometimes you know the kids went out.
Eric, you're coming back.
And Ozzy and Sharon would be in bed, right. And you know they let us shoot. That's what was great about the show too, is that they let us shoot everything.
Wow.
The only room we weren't allowed to go in was Ozzy's private bathroom downstairs. That was it.
Fair enough.
That was his sanctuary.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. I remember watching Ozzy shuffling around in his bathrobe. He was always in his bathrobe. Is that right?
I know. He was like Hugh Hefner.
But he was just always shuffling about and confused as hell. And then Sharon was just running the show. She's just such a type A personality and such a leader. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, Ozzy, you know, he was kind of going through a bit of a difficult time in his life. You know, he was in and out of, you know, substance abuse and the second season was difficult for him because Sharon, you know, was diagnosed with cancer. So he had a very, very hard time with that. And, you know, he was medicated, you know, a lot.
He seemed medicated. Yeah.
Yeah. but, you know, he pulled through. And I mean, if you see him now, I mean, you can understand everything that he says. And what I loved about Ozzy is that he was so funny and such a gentle soul. And I sometimes I wondered whether he realized how funny he was, but he was so charming, and the whole family, they were extremely gracious.
That's
and
nice.
So welcoming to us. And you know, like the first season, we spent New Year's with them, and you know, we toasted in their kitchen, and they had a big spread of food, and just a lovely, lovely family.
Yeah. Oh, that's so nice to hear. I remember, you know, just all the hubbub around that Beverly Hills house because the tour vans would go by. It was a big deal.
Well, you know, I think it was Jack told a funny story about, you know, the show was kind of inspired from an episode on Cribs, where they did, they went to, you know, their house.
Uh-huh.
And it was very, very popular. So a lot of kids who were around Jack's age knew where the house was. So they would come to the house. So I guess one day Jack's upstairs in his room with his friends and some young guy knocks on the door. And Ozzy didn't even ask him anything. He says, oh, he's upstairs. And he was just some strange, random kid.
Let him go up.
And he let him look up to Jack's room.
I seem to remember stuff flying out the windows as well. Like,
oh, well, there was one great episode where their neighbors were playing loud music. No, they were playing loud music, but it was like shitty music.
Right, right.
And Sharon took a ham from the refrigerator.
That's
and
it.
Threw it. And threw it over the fence. I was there that night.
That
and the police came.
So funny. That was a big deal.
Yeah, God damn. It was great.
I'm so happy you got to work on that. It's really interesting that you describe it as something that you continue to chase in your life, the feeling of that production on that show.
Well, you know, it was so real.
Yeah.
And, you know, after that, I did Newlyweds, which was equally, as real.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
Last Comic Standing.
Last Comic Standing was kind of a different type of show because it was a competition show. But I did a series of docu-series leading up to Last Comic Standing. And it was a rude awakening, my first show after Newlyweds, because it was not real. And, telling people what to say. And I worked on reality shows where there was actual writing, like a writer's room.
Yeah.
Which to me was ridiculous. It's like...
They're plotting out the whole thing.
Yeah, it's like, well, this you can't call this reality. I mean, this is like the furthest thing from reality. So the whole genre has changed quite a bit.
Sure.
And I've broken a lot of people's hearts by my honesty. I've burst a lot of people's bubbles when they would say, oh, God, did you see that? And I was like, totally produced. Not real.
And they believe you, right? Or they don't believe you?
No, they do. They do.
So I told
you. But they don't care. But they don't care. Yeah. They don't care.
Yeah. Do you have an example of that by any chance?
I could give you general of, even just like reshooting stuff,
as soon as you reshoot, this is completely manipulated.
It's like, oh, we didn't get it. And it's like, well, then you didn't get it.
Yeah, maybe it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. Well, that's part of the show, that you didn't get it.
Yeah, recently here on Storyworthy, I was talking with another guest, and we were kind of having this exact same conversation, and I told her how our neighbor didn't believe that Survivor could be staged or that there was anything staged about Survivor. And I remember saying to her, Wendy, Carolyn downstairs works on props for Survivor. So go down there and talk to Carolyn. Like literally, she worked on the prop department on Survivor.
Right, right. Well, I always joke about some of these shows where it's like, Alone in the Wild or Alone and Scared. And it's like, how scared can you be when there's a camera crew there? So, you're never really in the danger that they're selling.
How could you be? Yeah, because somebody has to be shooting.
Someone's filming. What was real, do you remember that documentary? It was just so terrible. It was about the
grizzly bear?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who got killed by the bear.
That was awesome. That was such a great documentary because he flirted with danger for so long. And finally this bear just said, fuck you, man, and ate him up in a tent like a burrito.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So that was real.
That was awesome.
Right.
All right. Well, listen, I am thrilled that you're here, Sue, and I can't wait to hear your story, The Dog That Saved My Life. I know it's going to be a good one. I could just feel it. But before we get to Sue's story, you guys, I wanted to remind you that we are telling true stories every Sunday night on the Storyworthy Hour of Power. We are in our 26th show. That means we've been going for 6 months every single Sunday night from 6 p.m. till 7 p.m. Pacific time. And after the show, we've been playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show. So you guys, for more information on these shows, head over to storyworthypodcast.com. And at the very, very top, there's a link for tickets. And guess what? There's always a free option. Yes, because I'm a giver. And one more thing. I am splitting the shows up. And Story Smash, the storytelling game show, will soon be on Friday nights starting December 4th. The Storyworthy Hour of Power will remain on Sundays at 6 p.m. Pacific time. All right, you guys. She's here right now. Sue Kalinske. You've heard her talking. What a talent. She's just been working and working and working in Hollywood forever. Sue has also been nominated 3 times for an Emmy Award. And do you still blog sports as well? Or
I don't. I did it for probably around 4 years. And then, work just got in the way. And it was just difficult in my, in my schedule. But for this past, I write a lot of stuff on Facebook. So this past playoff season, I wrote recaps
Oh, nice.
For pretty much every game. And that's baseball is my favorite.
Yeah. So how were you doing last night?
I was nervous. I mean, you know, I grew up a Met fan, but I would say that in the vein of Goodfellas, the Dodgers are my Friday night, you know?
Well, I'm so excited. That was great. And the Lakers won too. So our city's on fire. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, literally.
Yeah, well, that too. Yeah, that's true. And I also know that you love to run. I love to run as well. And you ran the LA Marathon. Yeah.
Yes, I did.
What year?
2 years ago.
Oh, wow. Just recently.
Uh-huh.
Good on you. Good on you. Did you train for it or did you just go?
Oh, no, I train. I actually belong to a running group here in Long Beach.
That's and a blast.
Which I've been a part of this group for around 5 years.
Oh, that's great.
And even though I trained, it was probably the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah,
sure. And what's crazy is that, you know, during the training process, you actually do run a marathon. Like, I ran a marathon, like, weeks before the actual marathon.
Hmm.
And but you, I ran 26 miles, and it's 26.2.
Yeah,
right. So I felt like when the marathon came, I wanted to be able, you know, how you like you're able to carry over your credits from one college to another.
Right.
I wish that I could have just carried the .2.
Yeah.
And just gotten my medal, because when I was doing the marathon with my group, we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was cool. There were no hills. And it was so manageable that I was like, oh, I got this.
Wow.
But the LA Marathon,
yeah.
You start much later. It was hot.
Yeah.
There were hills.
Yeah.
And there was a point where I was like, you know, I don't know if I'm going to make this, but, you know, I told everybody I was doing
yeah,
it. So,
I understand.
You know, and you know, you have all these people outside that are cheering you on. And then you have some of these boneheads that are like, oh, 20 more miles. It's yeah. It's only 20 more miles.
Only 15
you got
more
this.
Miles. Yeah,
I'm assholes. Like, really? It's just 20 more miles?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
people
yeah,
can
it
be
was
such
hard.
Assholes. Yeah, I love races as well. I love running races. Well, congratulations, because that is a really big deal. And, you know, when it comes to running, nobody can do it for you. And I always thought about that when Oprah ran her marathon. That impressed me so much because she did that. You know, there's just no doubt about it. You can't take it away. It's pretty
right.
cool. Anyway, yeah. like we were talking about, you are sort of known, I guess, for Top Chef, The Osbournes, Sex and the City, and Last Comic Standing. All right, you guys, you can find Sue over on Facebook. And listen, folks, wherever you are, put your hands together for the amazing Sue Kalinske.
So around 20 years ago, I got a job offer to do morning radio with Steve Mason, who is my podcast partner today. And so it meant leaving my boyfriend of like 16 years and the dog that we shared. And I was excited to go to New York, but, you know, it was probably harder for me to leave my dog than it was the actual boyfriend.
Where were you?
I was living in LA.
Oh, you were here. Okay.
And but it was a heady experience. It was a great experience. I grew up listening to WNEW. It was like one of the top radio stations of my childhood. And so I get to New York, and I get put up in corporate housing for 2 months. And I lived a very lonely existence because I was actually doing a lot of – I was still doing stand-up at the time, but I was morning radio. So I was getting up at 3 o'clock in the 3 o'clock in the morning, and we get on the air at 5. So we were 5 to 10, and then I come home, sleep, get up, watch TV shows, watch the news, prepare for the next day of being on the air. We had to tape a lot of stuff. So my life was so solitary. And you know, I was single for all intents and purposes because my boyfriend still lived in LA. So one day, I went to the supermarket around the corner from where I was staying, and on my way out, I'm carrying my packages, and I see a delivery truck and a little shepherd mix dog that could have only been a couple of months old tied to his truck. And I wasn't planning on on getting a dog. I'm like, you know, I'm only going to be here for a certain period of time. And the corporate housing where I was staying didn't allow dogs. So I just, but the dog looked so much like the dog that I shared at home that I fell in love with this animal. It was like this dusty colored shepherd mix that actually looked like a baby coyote. So there was the guy who owned the truck was inside, but I guess the guy who he was driving with, told me that the guy had found the dog in the Bronx that morning and was tying it up on every stop on his delivery, hoping that somebody would adopt the dog because he had like four dogs of his own and he couldn't take in another dog. So as I'm like, you know, ruminating whether I could even take the dog, all these people crowd around and were wondering if, you know, who's this dog? Is this dog, you know, up for adoption or whatever? So I just said, I'll take the dog. And, you know, it was like that feeling of, you know, being at an auction and being the last bidder and then realizing I have no money to pay for this. So, and then like some woman appeared and she heard me, you know, she saw that I wanted to take the dog and finally, you know, I meet the driver and he said, okay, well, I could bring you the dog tomorrow. And I said, okay, but I have to figure out where I'm going to put the dog because I can't keep the dog where I'm at. So this woman said to me, hey, I could call my vet because they board dogs and I'll see if maybe they could keep the dog for you. But it turned out that it was a holiday weekend. The vet was closed. The guy said, but, you know, he says, I can keep the dog, you know, a day and then I could bring the dog to you. And then I just figured out, I will figure this out. So the next day I go on the radio in the morning and I tell everybody that I found this dog and I don't have it yet, but I'm so excited. The guy said he was going to drop it off. He was at my friend's apartment at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So Kathy Ladman actually came on the show that day. She was in New York. And the apartment where we were meeting was an apartment that she shared with a friend. So, so Kathy's on the show and we're excited, you know, about me getting this dog. So, we get to the apartment and her roommate comes home and we're all waiting and 5 o'clock comes and, the guy was supposed to call me and he never calls and 5:30, no call, 6 o'clock, no call. I'm like, what is going on here? I was already like madly in love with the dog because that's who I am. I'll see a dog in 5 minutes and I'll think about the dog for the next, you know, the next 2 days. So anyway, I thought maybe the guy had a change of heart and he wanted to keep the dog. So finally at 7 o'clock, he calls me and tells me that he lost the dog.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, what do you mean you lost a dog? What happened? He said, I was driving in my car and I pulled over in Midtown Manhattan and I went to make a phone call. This is when people still used phone booths, outdoor phone booths. And I left the passenger side door open and the dog got out. And this was like in the middle of rush hour in Midtown Manhattan. And he saw the dog like running down the sidewalk and he started to chase after her, but she got away and that was it. And she was gone. And I'm like crying. Oh. And I was like, oh my God, I cannot believe how irresponsible this guy was. You know, it's like, you have four dogs. Oh, I guess at one point he said he had four, but now he had three. And I thought, well, maybe that's why he has three. Cause the other one dog got away.
Yeah. He let him go.
So, Kathy's roommate was like right on it, jumped into action. We made up flyers and put on the flyers, heartbroken, new owner, lost dog. And then, you know, a reward. So, we decided to go down to the area where the dog was lost. So we go down to Midtown. We're on like 47th and 5th or whatever. And we're all like, okay, you go this way, like a posse in the old West. It was like, you go this way, you go that way, and then we'll meet back in an hour. I was like, great. So, I went into like every store. I checked with every homeless person to see if they were, hovering, under a blanket with a dog, talked to people in the neighborhood, and nothing. So we meet back in an hour, and the joke was that during our frantic search, every one of us admitted that we window shopped for like shoes and handbags, like three times during our search. So the next day, So we did put flyers up in the whole area. So the next day, I go to work, and everybody's like, "Oh, so what's your dog's name? You know, I can't wait to hear about your dog." And I said, "The dog's name is Lost." And they were like, "What?" And I said, I told them the story about what happened, and I was so beside myself on the air. Now, granted, this was kind of the beginning. I was only on the air for maybe a month or so, month and a half. And my boss was like worried about me because I couldn't keep it together on the show because I was so upset. So he offered WNEW at the time was a rock station that was, it was kind of turning to all talk. So at the time we were still playing some music and doing basically interstitial talk. So he offered anybody who found my dog tickets to, I don't even know, some concert. And in the meantime, I called up the newspapers. I got a hold of someone at the Daily News. I told them what happened. They put a blurb in the paper that I lost the dog, anybody with information. And then I actually contacted the woman who was going to help me board the dog at her vet. We exchanged phone numbers, and we took turns every other day going to shelters in Manhattan to see if anybody had brought this dog in.
What was the description you were giving people?
I put, I guess, like shepherd mix, puppy, sandy color. You know, it was a dusty colored dog, so it was very unique looking. And it had like yellow, like golden eyes. So she went to a shelter. I went to a shelter, and I got to tell you, man, it was like Schindler's List, man. It was like Auschwitz for dogs, because there was a shelter on the Upper East Side that had like three floors of cages. And when I went there, it was so sad and so depressing. But she was not there. So then, Around the following week, I get a phone call from a woman who tells me, because my phone number obviously was on the flyer, who said she knew who had my dog. And I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, it's the weirdest thing. She lives in New Jersey. They've had the dog for the past week. She found the dog. The dog came up to her in the city. And, but they're hard pressed to return the dog." And she said, "I actually wasn't even going to call you because I thought you were an irresponsible dog owner." Like, whatever. So, she said, and I said, "Look, you know, what I really want to do is I want to come to the woman's house and I want to see if it's actually the dog, because I don't want to stop looking for the dog if it's not the dog." So she said, "They really don't want to give the dog back." And I said, I'm not going to try to like steal the dog. I said, "I just want to make sure it's the dog." And she said, "Okay, fair enough." So she said, "All right, I'll let them know, and I'll get back to you." So I'm like, I don't know, something like weird about this. Anyway, the next day she calls me and says, "Do you still want the dog?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Why?" I said, "I thought they wanted to keep it." And she said, "Well, it's a puppy, and they have another dog." And I'm like, "What, does everybody have like multiple dogs so they can help pay the rent? You know, it's like, what is going on here?" So she said, you know, they want to give you the dog back. And I said, okay. So she said, the husband is going to call you and he's going to make the arrangements. I said, great. So the next day, the husband calls me and he says, you know, you're very lucky because this dog is amazing, but we just don't have the means right now to take care of it. He says, my wife is completely insane and she rescues a lot of animals and we just cannot take on another animal. And the dog, you know, isn't house trained. And, but the dog is so, so sweet. So I said, okay. So we arranged, he was going to, bring the dog to his friend who I'd been in touch with. He was going to bring it to her apartment. She lived up on the upper east, on the upper west side, I believe. And, so I guess it was a Wednesday on the following Friday. So I was like, okay. So, I called up the woman who I had been in touch with, who was helping me try to board the dog. Cause I didn't want to go to some strange woman's apartment by myself. So I called her up and I said, would you come with me? She said, absolutely. So we go and, I never called the woman to tell her I was bringing somebody. So the woman answers the door and she's very, very attractive, impeccably dressed. And she looks at me and I, you know, I introduced myself and then she said, who's that? Like kind of snotty. And I said, oh, you know, this is, she was with me when I first found the dog and I just, you know, didn't want to come here by myself, blah, blah, blah. And she looks at me and says, well, you should have told me you were bringing somebody. And I said, whoa, you know, I didn't think it really was an issue. You know, I live in New York. I'm savvy, you know? So we go inside and she said, the dog's not here. He's on his way. And I said, okay. So we sit down and she says, would you like a, you know, then she kind of like settles in and she be, you know, is kind of becomes a human. And she says, would you like a glass of wine? And I said, yeah, sure. Thank you. So she says, I have to come clean. And I look at her like, okay, I'm intrigued. I said, what's going on? And she said, I'm the one who found your dog. And the husband who you talked to is my husband. I said, what? I said, what happened? And she said, well, I was at work sitting at my desk, which was like, you know, an open cubicle setting. Apparently the dog walked into her building and got into the floor where the offices were and just sat in front of her while she was at work. And she's like, what? So she grabbed the dog, and as she was leaving the building, one of our flyers was perfectly just happened to be placed in her eye shot. And she said, you know, and that's what she said, I was hard pressed to return the dog to you because on the flyer, it didn't really give details. And I thought you were an irresponsible dog owner because it didn't have tags and it wasn't chipped and no collar. And I looked at her and I said, well, I couldn't put the whole story on the flyer that I found it from a truck driver and I didn't get the dog. I said, I just wanted the dog back. So I didn't give every detail. And I looked at her and I said, you know, if only the police in Wisconsin had had a more of a wherewithal when Jeffrey Dahmer was caught with a naked Laotian boy, they gave the naked Laotian boy back to Dahmer and you weren't going to give me this dog that you found after reading this sign. So she didn't see the humor in that. But anyway, then the husband showed up and it was the dog. And I'm like, oh my God. So they had gotten shots for the dog and they had a little kennel for the dog and they bought like toys and all this food. And they, you know, they were like, you know, she was like, I really want to be in your life and I want to be in the dog's life because, you know, I feel so bad that we can't keep the dog, but just the way our lives are. And it was something kind of funky because she had an apartment in Manhattan, but they had a house in New Jersey. So I guess she lived in Manhattan maybe during the week because she worked in Manhattan. Anyway, so we actually did remain friends for like a little bit. And then she turned out to be a little bit of a psycho. And I just kind of cut my relationship off with her. So after I got the dog, I had moved into an apartment that was a dog-friendly building. And but I, you know, I worked at, you know, I had to be at work at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I was in this great doorman building, which was around the corner from the station. And I knew nothing about the dog. All I knew was that I had it and it was sweet. And it, you know, and that was all I knew. So I leave for work and I come back around nine something. And my doorman says to me, what time did you come home to last night? And I was like, well, that's kind of a personal question. And he said, your dog cried and barked for hours and disturbed everyone on your floor. And I had just moved in, so I hadn't met anybody. So, and being that I didn't know anything about the dog, there was no reason to say, hey, I just got a dog. So I felt terrible. I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I mean, I there's no way in the world. I went through all of this to not keep the dog. So I put flyers under everyone's door and apologized. And I said, I'm really, really sorry. I just moved in, you know, please don't hate me. And I asked my my boss if I could bring the dog to work. And he said, yeah, you know, he says, but, you know, it's not really up to me. It's really the building, but, you know, because it's not a dog-friendly building. But, you know, we were there at like, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. And by the time I left, that's when people were just starting to come to work. So I figured, and we were, you know, we had the, like the ground floor. We had the whole area where the radio station was. So there just so happened to be an a building party. I don't know whether, I don't even know if there was a holiday or something, but I met the woman who owned the building. And I told her the story of how I had rescued this dog. It was lost and then found. And she said, great story, really appreciate it, but I can't let you bring the dog to work. It's just policy of the building. So I was like, what am I going to do? So one of my bosses said that, he said, I'll take the dog, you know. And I was like, oh God, I really did not want to give it to him. He says, let me check with my family. Thank God the family did not, you know, they decided not to take her. So crazy enough, the next day, actually, I went through a period of trying to, like, I had like one of those citronella collars that sprays because she, you know, she had separation anxiety really, really bad. And she never destroyed anything, which was kind of unusual. And then one day I put my tape recorder on while I was gone to just see how long she cried. And I had the TV on. So I had CNN on. So I had Moneyline was on. So the only time she cried was when Lou Dobbs came on and started talking about the stock market. And I played it on the air the next day. And I was like, apparently she didn't invest wisely. So maybe that's why she was crying. So anyway, so a couple of days goes by and I'm walking her down my street. And this middle, like, I guess this guy was around maybe 50 years old, this African-American guy and a young African-American woman are walking together and they're approaching me and they compliment the dog. And I said, you really like her? I said, do you want her? And they said, what? And I said, I just don't think I can keep her because I, you know, I do a morning radio show and my hours are crazy and she barks incessantly. And the guy looks at me and says, I'll take care of her while you're at work. And I said, what do you mean? I said, I don't even know you. I mean, you know, and he looked like a kind of like a gentle giant, you know, very, very sweet guy. And he said, I'm going to give you a reference and you can call this guy and he'll vouch for me. And I called up the guy and he kind of told me what the guy's story was. You know, he said he's kind of been out of work. You know, he washes windows or whatever, and he could really use the money. And he will take care of your dog. You have nothing to worry about. And I used to go back to L.A. periodically to see my boyfriend. So I was actually going away in like 2 weekends. And this guy came to my apartment at 4 o'clock in the morning, Monday through Friday, walked there from Chelsea, which was like 30 blocks away, took her, took care of her. There was a restaurant next door to where he lived. He had been living in this building like since he was a kid. They let him bring the dog into the restaurant. He would bring her back when I came off the show. He took her when I would go away for a weekend. I became friendly with the guy. He and his girlfriend, that young woman who was probably, you know, 30 years his junior, they were boyfriend and girlfriend. I took them out for their birthdays. They became part of my family. And then when I moved, this guy was like a baby, just crying because the dog was kind of like his dog, you know? And I said, and he said, can she stay here? And I said, oh, Gary, I wish I could do that for you. I said, but I'm in too deep with her. I love this dog way too much. And, you know, when I say she saved my life, you know, she really did, because I was so alone living there. You know, I mean, I very rarely went out, you know, just to do stand up periodically. But she was my buddy. And then she came back to LA with me, and I had her for like 10 and a half years.
Oh, wow. That's a great story. What was her name?
Sam.
Oh my gosh. So you basically raised a dog in New York with the help of a stranger.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how many years do you think he walked her?
Oh no, just for around... around a year.
About a year.
Around a year. Because we did the show like maybe a year and a half. We were on the air from January to the following April. We were on the air.
And you were producing the show? What were you doing?
No, I was on air.
You were on air talent.
Yes. Steve and I co-hosted the show.
That is so interesting. And now you guys, you know, 25, 30 years later, are together again doing this podcast.
Yes.
I think that's stunning. I think that's really interesting. Boy, you guys must be very, very tight friends.
We really are. And, you know, we kind of went through, you know, a gap where, you know, we didn't see each other and talk to each other that much. But over the past probably 3 or 4 years, he's been hinting at doing a podcast together. He's like, God, you know, it'd be really, really, it would really be fun to recapture what we had with no rules, no bosses, just do our thing. And look, there's a lot of competition within the podcast world, but we were up against Howard Stern. So that was, you know, that was a tough gig for us.
Wow. The morning show.
Yes. Yes.
And
yes.
When you guys were up against Howard Stern, was that, I mean, you weren't really in competition because it was a different kind of show, right?
But just for listeners.
Ratings, yeah, just for ratings. Yeah, for sure. And then you came back here to Los Angeles. Did you continue seeing that guy or
that boyfriend? Yeah, there's an addendum to that. So came home, the dog that we had together and Sam, the other dog was Monty. So Monty and Sam got along famously and the boyfriend and I not so much. So we split up like 3 or 4 months after I came home. You know, we were together 16 years on and off. We were together.
Wow.
So that really put a toll on took a toll on our relationship being apart.
Are you guys still friends? Because I didn't see him or not.
Sadly, he actually passed away. You may even know who he was. Ken Ober?
No.
Did you know Ken Ober?
No, I don't.
Ken Ober, do you remember the show Remote Control?
Yeah.
On MTV?
Yeah.
He was the host of Remote
Control. He was the host. Oh, wow.
Kenny.
Why? How did he pass away so young?
He had a heart attack.
Wow.
At like 52.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
But we remained really, really good friends.
Yeah, that's
for
nice.
For all the years that followed, that's we remained nice. Very, very good friends.
Oh, that's good to hear. You know, I was listening to the story, and it truly sounds and reads like a children's book.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Like, I keep thinking how you turn the pages and then they looked, you know, then they split up and they went, one went this direction, one went this direction, one went this direction, you know, and they still didn't find the dog because I kept thinking it was going to be done. And then it was like, then there's another thing and then another thing. And it's really, really, really cute because it keeps coming back to your love of this little puppy that you didn't even know that well.
You know, there were all these obstacles that came in the way. And to me, the driving force was, I got this dog back after she was lost in Midtown Manhattan.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's so unbelievable.
So how I was so meant to have this dog.
Yeah,
and no, the universe no proved it.
Yeah, no kidding. Did you name him before you found him again, or did you name him Sam? After you, or did the other people name him Sam?
They named the dog Samantha.
Is that right? Wow.
And the funny thing is that I have a niece, Samantha, and during this time, I left this out of the story. During this time, my niece was and is a ballet dancer. Mm-hmm. She teaches now, but then she was actually performing. And she was around 16, 17. She got a gig dancing with
American Ballet Theater, ABT.
It wasn't
American. School of American Ballet, SAB?
Oh, God. I'm blanking on some big dance company.
Yeah.
A big company in New York. And they were, they provided a family who were supposed to put her up during her 6-week stint.
Yeah.
And it was, like the heat of that summer was a deadly, deadly summer. So anyway, it fell through and she had nowhere to stay. And I lived in a studio apartment, like 350 square feet studio apartment, with a futon bed, you know, like couch bed. So, my sister called me and said, can Samantha stay with you? And I was like, how could I say no? I mean, I love my niece.
Yeah,
and
you have to say
she's
yes.
a dancer, and she's been dancing since she's 3.
Yeah.
How could I say no? And I love her. We're very close. So she stayed with me. So her name is Samantha, and I call her Sam, and my dog's name is Sam. And so many times during her stay, I would say, so Sam, and she'd say, what? And I said, no, I'm talking to the dog. You know, like, so aww. We did that back and forth for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
But,
that's adorable.
Yeah.
When I think about those tiny apartments in New York, like I'm sure I could have pulled it off in my early 20s, but now I think there's no way I could live like that. No way.
Well, you know, to me, what the beauty was about this apartment, it was a really nice studio. It had like what I mean about that, it was a doorman building. It had a lot of windows that overlooked the Hudson.
Mm.
Okay, so I had an amazing view. It had a kind of a crazy amount of closet space for a studio, and I just had the bare necessities. And I'm a neat freak, so. It was like I had my bed,
yeah.
I had a night table,
yeah.
I had a dresser, I had a desk and a coffee table and a cool rocking chair. And that's it. And I actually had a little counter it was a small kitchen, but it had like a little seating that had a window overlooking the Hudson. So I had a little counter so I could kind of sit in my kitchen. So it was really, really sweet. And, you know, it was on 56th. Between 8th and 9th.
Amazing.
So it was near Central Park.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It was really a lovely, cozy place.
Oh, that's really nice. I think about my brother. He always goes, honey, all I need is a bowl and a spoon. That's all I want. I don't need anything else. I don't want any crap. Just give me a bowl and a spoon.
Well, you know, people, you know, a lot of people go for the tiny houses and all that. And, you know, sometimes I think, I don't know, I think if I had to, I could probably live in something like that. My husband and I, we do a lot of camping, and we used to have a pop-up, and then we graduated to a travel trailer, and it's in our backyard when we're not using it. And it's my little fort. It's my girl fort.
That's
and
adorable.
I go in there. It has a queen size bed.
Yeah,
exactly. Smoke some pot. I'll read a book. I'll bring my computer in there. It has a dining table.
I get it. That's cool.
It's very
man.
Comfortable.
Yeah,
and has a bathroom and a little kitchen.
Oh man, and you could be renting that out for $1,500 a month.
It's true. So I could live small.
Hey, listen, this was a really good story, Sue. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I hope you'll come on my Sunday show. It's called the Story Ready Hour of Power, and I hope you'll share a story too there as well.
Absolutely. Anytime.
All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented Sue Kalinske. Find her over there on Facebook, and then you can find me over there as well. And also, don't forget to follow me on Twitter, @StoryWorthy. And, oh, man, you guys, let's all cross our fingers that today we see a huge blue wave. We need this. Okay, America, let's hope it's happening. Sue Kalinske, yes. I'll never forget spending my election day with you. Thank you.
Hey, you know, some people have Paris.
We'll always have election day. All right. Thank you so much, guys. My name is Christine Blackburn Singh. Make it a story for you.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
Angie's List is now Angie, your home for everything home. Angie still has the same top pros and reviews you've counted on for more than 20 years, only now you'll also get access to all the tools you need to make your home a happy place. Inside, outside, big or small, Angie helps you find the right solution for whatever you need done, all from your phone. It's simple to find upfront pricing and instantly book hundreds of projects. You can even search pricing guides to see what others paid for similar jobs and easily compare quotes from top local pros to make sure you're getting a fair price. From lawn care to repairing the AC to the project of your dreams, Angie has your home projects handled from start to finish. Plus, when you book and pay through Angie, they'll cover your project up to the full purchase price plus limited damage protection with their happiness guarantee. Make your home an Angie home. Check out Angie.com today. And for more on the happiness guarantee, go to Angie.com/happiness-guarantee.htm.